history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They're not going to call themselves that, instead reminding us of so many who made the ultimate sacrifice. But we can call them heroes after we take the time to examine what they were willing to do for our country. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we end up inspired by these stories from people who know they might not have too much time left here on Earth. 99% of the veterans we hear from on Hometown Heroes served in World War II. Every once in a while, there's an exception to that rule, and that's the case this week as we prepare to mark Independence Day and the 240th birthday of the United States on July the 4th. We're going to hear from a decorated Vietnam veteran today who also knows his time is running short. I started interviewing World War II vets in 2005 because they were leaving us at such a stark rate. All these years later, the reality is that our Korean War vets and Vietnam vets are dwindling too. And while those conflicts had different dynamics than World War II, the people in uniform were no less heroic. And over the years on Hometown Heroes, you've heard many a World War II veteran share his frustration at the way that Vietnam veterans were treated when they came home. Some of those World War II vets have fought back tears as they remember their sons who never got to come home, whose names ended up among the more than 58,000 inscribed in black granite in our nation's capital. Today, our Vietnam veterans are leaving us too quickly and too early. So many of them, because of the effects of Agent Orange, the infamous defoliant that has changed the lives of millions of Vietnamese people as well. The man we're going to spend the hour with today is also battling cancer that he traces back to his time in Vietnam. Not from Agent Orange, but from a moment that was supposed to save his life, and instead, barring some kind of medical miracle, will end up shortening it. A listener named John in Bakersfield, California, told me I needed to catch up with Jack Craig, a decorated vet who was in the headlines there recently because he and his wife Carol donated funding for not one, but two police canines for the Bakersfield Police Department. Listen closely and you'll become aware that the Craigs are fond of felines too. And in between the occasional meows, you'll hear a man who returned from Vietnam bearing wounds both visible and invisible. And a story that may give you some insight into some of the things the veterans in your life may have left unspoken. We have the privilege of celebrating our country's 240th birthday because generation after generation of courageous Americans have put their lives on the line to preserve our ideals. So enough from me. Let's talk to someone who has done just that. Jack Craig of Bakersfield, California.
I imagine as you're growing up around Enid, Oklahoma, the World War II and Korean War veterans were your parents, your uncles, your friends, dads, and everybody around town, huh?
Yes.
Did you hear much about the military growing up?
No, actually not. I got a half-brother. He now lives in Texas. He was in Korea. And no one else in the family had anything to do with the military except my older brother. Well, I have an older brother that went to the National Guard. I virtually went in the military in the dark. It's not like I wanted to go to Vietnam or anything like that. And I didn't want to go to war, but it's what my government told me to do. So that's what I had to do.
I know that's almost 40 years.
Yeah.
Actually, that's almost 50 years now.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, get your math straight. Yeah, that's almost 50 years when you decided to go then. And you're drafted, but you didn't want to wait to find out what was going to happen there. You said, I want to go right now. What possessed you to do that?
I've always had to wait for everything in my life. And I've worked since I was 8, 9 years old with my dad at a carpentry. I just decided that I didn't want to wait for someone else to decide what was going to happen to my life.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's the way most of my brothers and my dad were, is they just didn't like waiting for other people. My dad's favorite saying was every time he think I was doing something slow, he'd say, "Come on, got a dollar waiting on a dime." So, okay. I didn't volunteer to be an infantryman, but because I scored high in general intelligence and things like that, and infantry was where they wanted me, and I wanted to say, I said, okay. Then I went to school, got my E5 stripe as an infantry sergeant, and then went to Vietnam.
How did you feel about that? I mean, you hear so many different takes on the situation, and as time went on, I mean, over the next few years, I'm sure you were going to hear a lot of things you didn't expect to hear, but at the time, what were you thinking as you prepared to head over to Vietnam?
I was thinking that, God, I hope I make it home and reach 30.
Hmm.
But I knew it was what my government wanted me to do, and so I did it. I did not really know a lot about Vietnam, because in Oklahoma, we didn't have the protesters like they did, like the Jane Fondas and all of them out here in California.
Right.
We didn't have that back there. Oklahoma is a lot like Bakersfield. It's a very, very, very patriotic place.
Well, isn't Bakersfield the Oklahoma of California?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I call it Western Oklahoma.
Absolutely. That's why there's so many Sooners fans around here.
Yeah. Almost everybody I have met in the last 10, 15 years has a relative or came from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. A lot of folks came out during the Dust Bowl, but then there's the oil connections and all that too.
Yeah.
So you said, so you hadn't heard a lot of the furor, the uproar, the controversy about Vietnam. You just knew that's where a war was and that's where you're supposed to go.
Right. And I was ready, willing, and able.
Mm-hmm.
I used to carry a gun and go hunting 2-3 times a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I haven't picked up a gun, but I think one time since I've been home from Vietnam, other than when I was still in service.
Mm-hmm. What did you find when you got over there? What was your welcome to the war moment?
Well, my welcome to the war moment was getting off of an airplane and looking around and not seeing any buildings. You know, they were Quonset huts or big bunkers of sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
And living in sandbags. I got checked in and they settled it, and I got my gun and everything and all of my gear from the company to go to out to the field, and then they put me on a helicopter and took me out to the LZ, or the forward fire base is what we called them. It was just north of Duc Pho and south of Chu Lai. I got off the helicopter there and I looked around and I didn't see anybody dressed as army. You know, everybody was in t-shirts and shorts and pants and boots. And my welcome to the world was, Sergeant Craig, you know, you got to go do this. This is your unit, and this is your squad, and this is your area. Okay, well, this is what my job's going to be for a while. Then it was about 5-10 days later, we were on patrol, and set off a hand grenade into a bunker or a hole. We figured it was a spider hole for the Vietnamese, and it went off, and then we got a bigger explosion, and I caught a piece of shrapnel on my face, and I'm just bleeding out like a chuck stuck pig. And that was my real awakening to Vietnam, is that you never know whether you're going to get hit or not, and how it's going to hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I still have this whole side of my upper lip and this side of my nose is still numb. I can't shave because I'll cut myself completely in two right here because I can't feel it.
Mm. So you've had that mustache for a long time?
Yeah.
Because otherwise...
Otherwise, I couldn't make it. I shaved it off one time, I think. Right, Carol?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was it. I never shaved it up after I got wounded there because I had a bandage across here.
Yeah.
To cover up the hole where the metal went through to my chin. In fact, the metal is still right there. It shows up in my dental x-rays.
Still in your cheek all these years later.
I've got metal all over my body. I've got about 18 or 19 pieces of metal in my body from a hand grenade ambush.
That makes airports fun, huh?
No, they're all small and they're all buried deep in my skin and they don't say anything to me about them.
Good.
The only thing that's really visible as far as scars or anything like that is my shoulder where I got shot. I got a bullet across the shoulder.
Right. And I want to hear about all those individual incidents, but so you're giving us a picture early on, you're confronted with this reality that there's probably really nowhere safe out here.
There is no place
safe. Even when you don't know where the enemy is and you don't even expect the enemy to be there, he's probably there.
He's there. And you can hear him every night.
What do you hear?
Parties in the villages and all, because we go out and we bunker down in a dry rice paddy, but, you know, and we would go to the village during the day, sit in the shade, that kind of thing. But you could hear the whoop roars and the partying going on in the villages almost every night. In fact, we sent a unit out of about six guys. They were real good. I mean, they were good because they could actually sneak up next to the village while they were partying and take care of it. And they had about 20 missions and about 22 or 23 people dead.
Wow. Do you remember the first time you had to deal with losing somebody you knew over there?
Yeah. One of the guys in my company, one of the other platoons, we were going down and we were going to go up to this rise so that we could settle down for the night. And we got toward to the top and a guy stepped on a bomb. And he lost his leg, and of course he was dead when it was all said and done. And then I found out, you know, when I was over there, there was about 125, 130 people killed in my unit.
Out of how many?
Well, they rotated us in and out.
Right. But your full strength was?
Full strength was about 150. And we were always about 5 or 10 short. Out of those 120 some odd people, there were 9 people that were actually shot with a bullet in combat. The rest of them were all victims of booby traps and what they call in the military now IEDs.
Right, the improvised explosive devices.
Tripwires and hand grenades and stolen claymore mines.
Well, I'm just imagining being in your shoes. So if guys are dying all the time like this and you know all these booby traps are out there, I mean, how do you take a step? How do you go anywhere? How do you go out on one of these missions and even lead these squads?
You have to watch where you step.
Yeah?
You have to take it on yourself. And as a squad leader or a platoon sergeant, it was my responsibility to make sure that they made it. And so I always stayed near the front of the unit, even though as a platoon sergeant, I was supposed to be taking up the rear. But I took on that role at the front of the group because I didn't trust the second lieutenants that were coming out of West Point and OCS and stuff like that because they just didn't have the common sense to slow down. You know, it was, you know, so I always stayed near the front of the unit so that I could see what was coming. You know, I mean, that's just the way I was.
Right.
I've always been one of those that would, even in civilian life, you know, if I won't do it, I'm not going to ask anybody else to do it.
Well, I'm sure the guys that served with you respected that and appreciated it.
Yeah.
But you just said you were responsible for those guys getting back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there were times where not all of you did.
Yeah, and it hurt. It hurt a lot. The first ones that I lost actually in my unit because we were ambushed. It hurt something fierce, and it was all I could do to pick up, move on, and not bawl like a baby, 'cause that's how I felt.
Yeah.
You know, I went over there, I was 20 years old, but I was still a kid.
Yeah, and all the guys around you were kids.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
I found a guy, this little gung-ho sucker, He had been in the Marines, and he was in the Army now. And he was on his third trip to Vietnam. And I says, 3 times you've been over here? He says, yeah, the first time I was 14. I says, 14? He says, yeah, I lied when I joined the Marines. And God. And then found out that he had been over there in the Army, and they'd found out that he was only 16, and they kicked him out. And he was 17 and a half, I think. He finally got his parents to sign so that he could join the service. And he was in my unit. Man. And I couldn't believe he'd already been there 3 times. And I couldn't believe that he wanted to stay.
What do you think was driving that?
He didn't have a thought process in his head that anybody could kill him. And he made it all the way through his tour. Mm. And never got a scratch.
Wow. You did. You were there over there less than a year.
Uh-huh.
But Purple Heart has been awarded to you twice. The Bronze Star, a total of 4 times, including a V for Valor. Sounds like that was a pretty action-packed 11 months for you.
It was. From March until the middle of October was hell. But yet it was very simple hell. Because when I woke up, I saw sunlight. I says, okay, I made it. I made it another day. Thank you, Lord. Mm-hmm. And got up and went going. Kept going. And that was it. If you saw the sun or even rain, but you woke up every morning, you thanked your lucky stars and you thanked God for letting you live another day. People like me, I never believed in organized religion.
Yeah.
My grandfather was a Baptist preacher, but I never went to an organized church. But yet, in the time that I was in the service, I prayed every single day to get through another day, because I never knew what was going to happen.
Well, we're going to hear some of the things that happened after our first break. We'll find out just how close Jack Craig came to never making it home, never meeting his wife, becoming a father and grandfather, never having the chance to drive his treasured classic car with a patriotic paint job. That's got to be the perfect convertible to cruise around in on the 4th of July. Check it out yourself in the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.